From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Bay Rihanna's Point.
Hayward.
Piedmont, California.
Pleasanton.
Fall Town.
Richmond.
Sunset.
Oakland, California.
Concord, California.
Fairfield.
Foothill.
Coming up, we'll stop and really listen to the world around us.
We can fool the eye, but we can't fool the ear too well.
Sound ecologist Bernie Krause says if we really listen, we'll hear an animal orchestra out there, and we need to protect it.
Fully 50% of the habitats that I've recorded are now quiet.
We'll visit all kinds of soundscapes from the urban racket of San Francisco's past.
The Barbary Coast, it was pretty rowdy.
To the music in today's ocean. Stay tuned for today's orchestra edition of Cross Currents.
So let's see here. All right, so
to help us tune in to the sounds of the Bay Area and what they're telling us, we've got two sonic tour guides on the show today. Audiograph producer Julie Kane.
Martina, what did you have for breakfast today?
Oh, gosh, I had pastry.
And our managing editor, Martina Castro, who's also producer of a series called Audiophiles. Yes, audiograph and audiophiles sound similar but different. It gets a little confusing around here.
We like to think of it this way, that audiophiles is conversations with people who work in sound, and
audiograph is stories about places, people who live there. That's really about the sound of the place where they live and what it means.
Julie and Martina are actually up in Muir Woods. It's a perfect place to start using our ears to learn about places and people, the natural world, how it affects us, and how we affect it.
So in the Bay Area, you know, we think about all the environmental impact of almost everything we do all the time, but we don't really think about noise. Noise as pollution, right?
You might not think you generate that much noise, especially when you're just sitting there listening. But really think about the last time you just heard the wilderness, even deep in nature.
Why don't we take a little listen? Even here, our voices in this park, the airplanes we heard, these are noises that actually pollute the environment in a way we don't usually think about.
But some people do think about it, and there's actually a kind of field of study that looks at this. It's called soundscape ecology.
It's kind of like looking at how a chemical plant would affect a river, or how, you know, we impact the oceans with our plastic, like that kind of thing.
Or how, you know, our car exhaust, you know, puts a big hole in the ozone.
Yeah, so one of the people who studies soundscape ecology is Bernie Krause. And the reason we're here in Muir Woods is because he came here when he decided to first record the natural world.
I was terrified to go out there alone. I mean, I thought that was really wild. I mean, never mind that the paths were all paved and everything like that, and there was signage everywhere. You could never get lost in there. But I went marching off there, and the moment I turned on that recorder and I heard that sound through my headphones, and it was really mostly just ambience. It was wind in the trees, and there were a few ravens and blackbirds. I think there were probably a few jays around. And as soon as I heard that sound for the first time, it changed my life.
We talked to Krause about 45 miles from Muir Woods in his studio in Glen Ellen in Sonoma County.
You love the door sounds.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Since that day in Muir Woods,
45 years ago,
he's recorded over 4,500 hours of soundscapes.
And he keeps a library of them here in his studio.
All right. So...
let me know when you're ready.
We're ready.
Ready.
Okay.
So take us on a tour. Where are we? What are we seeing?
Well, we're in my little lab, as it is. These are some of the tapes that I've recorded from around the world.
Can you read some of the names that are on the spines here?
Oh, we're looking at Nez Perce recordings up in Idaho. We're looking at Sumatra, Borneo, California, Oregon. Here's the Azores. Here's Antarctica.
Krauss says these recordings are unique sonic signatures of those places. They're as different from each other as Borneo is from Alaska.
And when you first listen to them, you might not be able to distinguish single sounds or animals. But after a while, a sort of organization starts to emerge from the cacophony.
It's pretty cool.
Take the state park surrounding Krauss's studio, for example.
First, the insects come in, and the insects start about August, late August, and they run through December. And then the frogs, the amphibians, and the reptiles come in to join the chorus, and they join the chorus about January after the first rains, and they're really loud.
Then the birds.
The birds are a constant all through the spring and into the summer.
And we hear coyotes and foxes barking and stuff like that, and they join the chorus later in April and May.
If you could really hear all of this with no interference, you might not need a calendar.
And the soundscape is just as important vital an indicator of where we are in time and place as any thing I know. I mean, I can't imagine having a visual cue that's stronger than those sounds.
And yet, there's something even stronger tying all these sounds together.
Krauss first noticed it on a recording trip to Kenya.
I was out there and it was late and I'd been recording for 30 hours or something like that. And I lay down in my tent and had my microphone in outside the tent and the recorder inside. And I was just listening to the sounds, and I was thinking, I was imagining a musical score, and at the same time, I was thinking, hey, wait a minute. These critters are doing the same thing. This is like proto-music. This is like, maybe we got something here.
So when he got home, he pulled up a spectrogram.
That's a way to see sounds in a recording, kind of like looking at a graph of everything you're hearing. And there,
sure enough, there were all these patterns there, and every critter was discriminated very clearly, just like notes on a page of music.
Wow, that's amazing. It's beautiful to look at. Using various shades of yellows, purples, pinks, and reds, it shows you how loud sounds are and where they lie on a spectrum of frequencies.
For those of you who don't quite get what a frequency is, it's the wavelength of a sound as it travels through space. That might not make any sense either, but the important part is this. The higher the frequency, the higher pitch you hear. Some frequencies are so fast or so slow that humans can't even hear them.
But you can see them. It's hard to believe that we can really look at sound this way.
He shows us another spectrogram. This one he recorded in the rainforests of Sumatra.
Look how pretty that is.
Wow. Krauss points out that you can clearly see each animal's call on the image, and there's a reason for that.
In wild habitats, if creatures want to be heard, and their lives depend on the sounds that they produce and receive, then they better have clear channels and bandwidth in order to be heard so that their voices aren't masked. Otherwise, they're not going to thrive.
Remember those 4,500 hours of recordings we mentioned earlier? Krauss has returned to several of those places.
And they've changed.
One example is a soundscape near an old-growth forest in the Sierra Nevada.
He recorded this in 1988, right before there was selective logging in the area. It was meant to be more sustainable than just clear-cutting a forest.
Krauss returned exactly a year later to the same exact place, and he says the forest looked the same,
but it sounded completely different.
Of the 4,500 hours I have, fully 50% of the habitats that I've recorded are now quiet. So they're gone. You can't hear them anymore. Either they've been changed by human endeavor, or they're impacted by human noise, or, you know, they're paved over by a Walmart lot. But they're gone.
Is that something you can actually hear with your ears, like an unhealthy habitat?
Yeah, there are people who can hear that. We can't in our culture because hearing isn't really the top priority for us. It's not how we get our information. We get our information through mostly what we see. We're a visual culture. And what we hear kind of takes a second-tier issue. But if we can hear well, then we need to be really quiet and listen to the natural world around us because it's healing. It's very informative. It has lots of information, tells lots of stories. It's a narrative of place. If you want to know where you are, listen to what's happening around you, and you can tell much more about the place that you're in by what you hear than by what you see.
That's Bernie Krause speaking with KALW's Julie Kane and Martina Castro. You're listening to an orchestra edition of Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We're calling it an orchestra version of our show as an homage to Bernie Krause's book called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. So how do you do that exactly? This is how Bernie Krause explains it.
First of all, you shut the hell up and you be really quiet. And you stop talking and you stop thinking and you stop, you know, considering what you're going to do next, and you put your iPad away and your iPhone away, and you just pay attention to what's coming into those ears of yours, and you sit very quietly for long periods of time. For one thing, to learn this and to one of the things that I've used to learn it is a tool called a recorder, and if you have a recorder, you've got to be very, very quiet. You can't be rubbing your clothes. You can't be sniffing or coughing or scratching or stuff like that. You've got to be really quiet for long periods of time and let the sounds come into that instrument, that microphone.
Bernie Krause might use a microphone, but there are people whose ears are so sensitive that they hear music without meaning to. Here's one woman who's like that, dating a man who's not.
I remember one of our first dates, we were walking down the road, and she's like, "That's an F." I was like, "What are you talking about?" It's like, "The bus is an F." I was like, "Okay." It's like, "Oh my God, she's got perfect pitch. She's wonderful." Yeah, I think my mind was elsewhere at that stage.
Oh, once was a woman who lived in the woods, a willow, willow, wild, yeah. Once was a woman who lived in the woods, down by the riverside, yeah.
My name is Alan Callery. I'm a DMA in composition, which is studying for a doctorate in musical arts at Stanford University, and I'm a second year. I can't hear pitches. It's my confession as a musician.
My name is Doris Eifer. Having perfect pitch, once you hear a pitch, you automatically zero in on it. Your brain hears it. You recognize it. It's kind of satisfying, but at the same time, your attention will be completely diverted. And that does happen to me, where I'll be in the middle of a conversation, but the door just slammed and the pitch was a B. So, you know, oh, that was a B. Okay, now let's focus back on, you know, whatever it is. Electrical lights have a pitch. Usually it's like a B flat. Sometimes water has a pitch. Whistling has a pitch. Almost a lot of things have pitches. Crackling of keys. Sound of key turning in a lock. The hinges on a door. Door slamming. Yeah, and then when I met Owen, he said, yeah, some sounds don't have pitches. It's because I used to try and figure out all the pitches all the time. And kind of think that I failed for some reason when footsteps didn't make a pitch, but they don't.
I would say that a pitch for me is the thinnest possible tone. It's like trying to describe, like, I have a friend who's an artist, but he's colorblind. Like, he doesn't see blue. So all of his pictures are really strange, and, like, he has no idea what blue is.
Learning that I have perfect pitch, you know, I must have had it before, because people say that it's innate, that you're born with it. When I was 6 or 7, I started playing piano for the first time. And my piano teacher was a musicologist, and my listening was very centered around classical music, mostly, and sort of what's pretty, what's correct. Somewhere around 11th grade, I stopped agreeing to listen that way, because at that point, I also stopped being a musician.
Pitch, it doesn't work in my ears. I don't know what impact it's had on the relationship, other than it makes me think about what I hear, and I think it makes her think about what she hears. The fact that it turns out we all perceive things differently, and the fact that I know that the person who I'm with and the person who I love perceives the world completely different to me, but isn't some weird alien that's going to threaten the order of everything. I think that, for me, teaches me something about humanity, that we make weird value judgments sometimes, and I don't know why.
That piece was produced by Natasha Ruck and Christy Hartman for State of the Human, a podcast by the Stanford Storytelling Project. It aired on a recent episode called Listening. You can hear the entire episode online. Just go to storytelling.stanford.edu, or you can find a link at klw.org. And while you're there, tell us about some of the musical sounds in your life. We've been collecting a few of our own. That's the sound of a foghorn, recorded by Ben Trefney, and a dripping tap, recorded by Mary Willis. We'll be bringing more of those to you throughout the rest of the show. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is an Audiophiles Audiograph Mashup edition of Cross Currents, as we bring our environment into focus through our ears. To set up this next piece, we'll drop back in on our tour guides, Julie Kane and Martina Castro, in conversation with Bernie Krause. Julie and I are in heaven as we make our way through some of Krause's favorite sounds in his library. This is the sound of wolves in Algonquin Park in Ontario, Canada.
There were two packs of wolves, one in front of me and one in back of me.
When Krause discovered the orchestral nature of the sounds he was recording, he thought he was onto something big.
As far as he knew, no one had done anything quite like this before.
Because all of the methodology to that time, and this is the early 80s, mid-80s, all of the methodology of recording in the field had been with the objective to fragment the soundscape, take things out of context and record them one at a time with these large parabolic dishes.
That's basically a microphone that looks like a satellite dish, and it works like a zoom lens on a camera, recording things that are far away.
Actually, the first guy to develop a parabolic dish was a fellow named Ludwig Koch, K-O-C-H, and he was a German fellow who moved to the UK, and in 1889 recorded the first bird.
That's a clip of that recording, featured in a BBC radio documentary.
So let's back up for a second, because we've talked a lot about recording natural sound, but that's not the only kind of sound there is.
I mean, there are probably two components to natural sound. One is the biophony, which are all the critter sounds that occur naturally, and the other is the geophony, which are the sounds, the effects of wind and water and rain, natural sounds that are non-biological. And the third is made up of human sound and the human soundscape, anthropony, but it's organized in a certain kind of human way.
Biophony, anthropony, and geophony. Those words didn't exist when Krauss started his work. He actually was the first person to use the term biophony. Nowadays, though, there's lots of people thinking about soundscapes in their entirety. It's actually a field of study.
We've created, in effect, a new model for dealing with natural sound, both marine and terrestrial environments, that's now incorporated into graduate studies programs at Purdue and Michigan State, and it's gaining traction all over the world.
We'll come back to that discussion between Julie, Martina, and Bernie Krauss in a bit, but let's spend some time listening to anthropony, human-made soundscapes.
I found some of the 19th century jokes pretty funny.
Could you tell me one?
No, not on air.
This is KALW's Casey Miner speaking with Andrew Roth, a sound designer who recreates soundscapes that no longer exist. You can hear his most recent work at the Conservatory of Flowers in San Francisco. The exhibit is called Boomtown, and it's what San Francisco sounded like in the early 1850s, when the city was known as the Barbary Coast. Here's Casey.
Andrew Roth and I are in the front room of the Conservatory of Flowers. It's a kind of misty atrium filled with plants from all over the world. To get into the Boomtown show, which is about urban San Francisco in the 1850s, we have to walk by a 100-year-old giant philodendron that rises all the way to the ceiling. I also have to cover my microphone so it doesn't get rained on.
Usually by the end of each show, everything you see in this room is broken except for the sound. The trains stop running, the lighting's all dead. The cockroaches have eaten through something. All glue's fallen off, but the sound keeps going.
The sound. If you walk in and close your eyes, it's like entering a crowded party. There's clanking, people talking, laughing, music.
This show is definitely the most cacophonous of all the shows I've done.
It seems like everything we walk by makes some kind of sound. There's a wooden stall in the center of the room that does triple duty as a photo booth, music box, and brothel. More on that later. There's a model train running around a bunch of tiny buildings. A model ship filled with the yells of an imaginary crew.
Do you know what this sounds like through headphones?
Through headphones?
Yeah. Have you listened to just what it sounds like? Would you like to?
Sure. We're not really in front of any particular speaker right now, so we're getting the full messy mix. It actually doesn't sound too unlike an amusement park. But it's fun because you hear things like the seagulls stick out. And somehow you do get a feeling that it's older. You're hearing older music. You're hearing... It's mostly the music that really brings it alive. There's so much music in this exhibit. It's not all going on at once, but it does sound like it.
Circling the exhibit feels like walking from place to place in a city, except you're actually walking from speaker to speaker. There are about 24 of them placed around the room, so the different sounds come in and out of focus as you walk around. The little pockets of music are especially delightful. Hearing them feels like stumbling upon a tiny concert in an alleyway, like you've slipped into something tucked away.
Can you tell me what I'm listening to right there?
That's a man named Tim Twiss. On the East Coast, he plays a very old-style banjo. As you can tell, it doesn't sound like a bluegrassy banjo. It's a real gourd, strung with real catgut. So it's got and played in a very different style as well, so it's got a very mellow sound. And this is really what the banjo would have sounded like in the 1850s.
Catgut? Is that what you said?
Yeah, catgut. I think you have to order them from Europe now.
It's not easy to recreate the sounds of a bygone age. For one thing, you'll never really know if you got it right.
Basically, I try and do what I can with each sound, and then hopefully when you smush them all together in a mix, you get something that sounds just a little bit more original. I could have taken a bluegrass banjo, steel string, modern banjo, and taken just some old-timey sounding piano and all that, and it would have worked for the majority of the guests.
Not for everyone, though.
Actually, if you could record this. So, yeah, sorry. Which is one of the first instruments I look for, is an 1852 melodeon restored by a guy who's incredibly historically accurate in his restorations. And there's a whole subset of people, not a lot of them, and several of them are quite elderly, but their life is sort of dedicated to playing the right pieces in the right way, on the right instruments, made the right way.
Roth used a range of techniques to recreate the sounds of Boomtown. Lean into the central booth and you can hear women laughing in a brothel. Really, museum staff drinking wine and telling 19th century jokes that Roth found online. Push a button near the entrance and you can set off a really satisfying dynamite explosion.
All men clear out, she's gonna blow!
That's the sound of some other museum employees throwing furniture around an office. Circle the perimeter and you'll hear a Chinese musician, then sea shanties sung by local performers. The heave-hoing of a group of sailors bringing a ship into shore.
Hey, matey! Pull! Pull it! Pull!
There's sounds. I mean, just there's random stuff like the bank teller facade. There's counting money and gold, bags of gold being thrown down on the bank teller. Window, fiddle and guitar stuff that, again, like I'm playing the guitar sometimes over here. There's actually a lot, it only pops up here and there, but around the room you'll hear sort of clunking and clanking. There's just a lot of ambient sounds, like people walking on boardwalks that were recorded at Muir Woods on the boardwalk there. And, occasionally a church bell or that kind of stuff. It's more ambient stuff that's coming out of different places. There's also a brass band playing Civil War era brass instruments coming out of Union Square to give Union Square a little nice polish to it as opposed to the brothel. I think in a lot of the one reason why I'm attracted to the historical soundscapes too is to try and put yourself in another time and place in which you have things missing that you don't realize you hear in the present day. So an absence of 21st century sounds is important to me as well. So I need to get these sounds very clean, absent of planes going overhead and cars going by on the freeway next door and that kind of stuff, so that when I fix it all up, clean it up, mix it together, and you put the headphones on or whatever kind of exhibit setup you have, you can actually feel transported and not have it be sullied by 21st century sounds around you.
To do this, Roth sometimes drives hundreds of miles to other states to record exactly the right sound.
How long did it take you to design this exhibit?
It's hard to say. It takes a few weeks of me just thinking about it in the shower. And then I start to just gather the sounds, think about what sounds I have in my big library, and then think about what are sort of the most unique sounds that I want to go out and get record, like the melodeon, for instance, or the banjo. I mean, these are things that are very specific. Oh.
In an instant, every one of those specific sounds disappears. We realize it's 4:30. The exhibit's closed for the day, and it has an off button.
For me, it's both peaceful and also kind of shows you what sound can do. As far as making the space feel different. Not just making it exciting or not exciting, but actually make it feel bigger or smaller or more interesting.
It's a physical change. I mean, it feels like a physical change.
Yeah, sound is cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's Andrew Roth speaking with KALW's Casey Miner. You can see and hear Boomtown Barbary Coast at the Conservatory of Flowers through April 14th. For more information and to hear more from our audio file series, you can go to our website, KALW.org. Here are a couple more musical sounds we found in our daily lives. This is the sound of oatmeal, recorded by Lila Day, and the sound of a brewing coffee pot, recorded by Christine Stolakis.
We can actually feel sound. If it's loud enough, you can, and low enough, you can feel it. It's visceral.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba, and that's Bernie Krause. He's dedicated decades to recording natural soundscapes from around the world. He's been speaking with KALW's Martina Castro and Julie Kane about his work in soundscape ecology and his massive library of sound. We now rejoin their conversation.
Krause actually got his start in music. He was trained in violin at a very young age.
Later, he recorded with some big-time musicians like The Doors, The Monkees, Stevie Wonder, and George Harrison.
He was among the first musicians to experiment with synthesizers, and he worked on movies like Rosemary's Baby.
What have you done to it?
And Apocalypse Now.
But he was looking for something more, and in 1968, he and his creative partner, Paul Beaver, decided to make an album that would incorporate natural sounds.
The album was called In a Wild Sanctuary.
When Beaver passed away suddenly, Krause took that as a sign and left the musical world for the natural one, for good.
Finally, in 1979, I went back to school and got my PhD in bioacoustics, finished it in 1981. And little by little found ways to, kind of make a living at it by recording in the field for museums and aquaria and zoos and doing installations, sound installations in these various places.
He's been building his collection of soundscapes ever since.
What we're looking for is we're looking for a home for this archive, an institutional home, place where it's going to get some use, where people can study what's happening to the changing soundscapes. And what I want is I want a place that's going to deal with this thing in an interdisciplinary way, one that's going to involve not only biology and bioacoustics and music and theater, medicine. All of these things apply to this particular collection.
I don't know if you want to take a break, but I have one other follow-up question, may sound stupid, but... just imagine, for someone who might not understand what that means or why that's important, could you answer why is it something that we should... Why should we care about that?
You want to care about that for the same reason that you want to care about animals disappearing from the face of the planet. And it's important because it's a language. And it's important to preserve because it has that narrative in it. And it's a historical narrative. It's a musical narrative. It tells us about so many things about ourselves and how we're doing in relationship to the rest of the living world around us. That's why it's important. For me, I can't think of very much more important because it really signals how quickly things are changing. And especially with global warming, which I think is the most formidable thing we've got to deal with now. So I would just pay some very careful attention to that and hope that others would too, because contained within it is all the stuff we need to know. Mm-hmm.
That's Bernie Krause. He spoke with KALW's Martina Castro and Julie Kane. If you want to know more about Krause's field of study, soundscape ecology, you can read all about it in his book, The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. And here's another piece of music from a somewhat less wild place, an egg carton held closed with a rubber band.
Hi.
And that was a 3-year-old child. Those sounds were recorded by Alyssa Kapnick. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Remember those three classes of soundscapes that Bernie Krause was talking about?
I mean, there are probably two components to natural sound. One is the biophony, which are all the critter sounds that occur naturally. And the other is the geophony, which are the sounds, the effects of wind and water and rain, natural sounds that are non-biological. And the third is made up of human sound and the human soundscape, anthropophony. But it's organized in a certain kind of human way.
Well, geophony was the first category of sound on the planet, and it's the focus of this week's audiograph game. But before we give you the answer, we've been playing this game for a few weeks now, so we thought it was time to have audiograph producer Julie Kane give us a sense of how her project works. So, Julie, what is the core principle of audiograph?
Well, audiograph is really about listening, and it's also about where we live. So I started thinking about it because as a reporter, I say the words Bay Area 6 or 7 times a day. But when I say those words, I'm talking about San Francisco and Oakland pretty much. And really, the Bay Area is this huge region, 9 counties in the Bay Area, and most people who live here cannot name all 9 counties. And I just thought, you know, we're all from so many different places. We all live in this region together, and sound is this great way to start connecting the dots and talking about where we live and what the stories are here.
So tell me more about why you chose sound as a medium.
You know, sound is really primary. One of the things I love thinking about is we can hear before we're born. We recognize our parents' voices immediately when we're born. And it's just this very primary experience, but it's also kind of hidden to us because we're such a visual culture. And it's also a way that we can really get led into stories by talking about what is surrounding us all the time.
So all of these audiograph sounds, people have heard them on KALW, are they leading you to stories then?
They're absolutely leading me to stories. And it's kind of an interesting thing. I was just up in Napa County and I was talking to these women who had lived there all their lives. And I was saying, you know, what's the sound of where you live? And they're like, it doesn't sound like anything. This is the country. It's super quiet. And so I said, you know, at my house at night, I always hear a freight train whistle. And I'm really curious, like, what is that? What's it carrying? Where is it going? I want to know more about that. And you know, I said, like, what if I blindfold you? How would you know you were home? What would you hear that would tell you? And they said, oh, actually, in the winter, it always sounds like helicopters outside our windows. And it's not really helicopters. It's these big fans that heat the grapevines all winter long. So they told me something that they hear all the time that told me a story about what happens up there that takes me into being able to talk about part of the Bay Area and what goes on.
And you also kind of taught them how to be attentive listeners. These are sounds that are just taken for granted in their everyday life, but now they can identify them.
I mean, it really made a light bulb go off. It was great. You know, it was a really great experience for them and me. And one of the things Bernie Krause says is, you know, there's this phrase, a picture is worth 1,000 words. And he says, a soundscape is worth 1,000 pictures. And I really like thinking about that.
And so you're using sounds to tell both big stories and small stories, right?
Right. So most people, I would think, have heard this game, this audiograph game, where we're playing you kind of a mystery sound and then we give you an answer. But we're also using it to tell bigger, more sort of documentary style stories about the life in each of the nine counties. And at the end of the project, we'll make a nice long documentary piece that really links together a lot of the stories that we're collecting and gives you a really nice sound portrait of the Bay Area.
And you said most people can't identify the nine counties. Can I try?
Please.
Okay. Alameda, San Francisco, Santa Clara, Marin, Contra Costa, San Mateo. There's three more?
Three more.
San Joaquin is not Bay Area.
No. I'll give you a hint. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a hint. We just talked about one. I just mentioned one.
Sonoma.
Yep.
I'm totally stuck.
Napa.
Napa is a county.
Yep.
Okay. And what's the last
Solano.
One? Solano. Solano County.
Solano is the one that no one can get. Solano is the mystery county. But you did great. Most people can't do that.
I always thought Napa was part of Sonoma, maybe, in my head. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, so that brings us to this week's sound.
Right. So all week long, we've been playing you this audiograph sound.
Everything that comprises this sonic environment, you'll be surprised because it's very complex.
And we asked you what you think it is and where in the Bay Area it's from. This week, KALW's Ashley Ann Krigbaum and Maya DePaula Haneke bring us the answer.
I'm Peter Richards, and we're at the Wave Organ, which is located on the end of the jetty that forms the Marina Yacht Harbor.
Richards is an artist, and the Wave Organ is his creation, a sculpture he built between Fort Mason and Crissy Field.
We can see downtown San Francisco, and we know how dense and frenetic that can be, but we're not there. But on the other hand, we can hear that boat going by there, and that's a whole other world, you know, and we're not there either, but we're a part of it.
You won't find it if you're not looking for it. It feels like the middle of nowhere. You have to enter the Yacht Club parking lot, drive all the way to the end. Then there's a trail to walk, so plan on ditching your car.
It really is this edge between the built and the natural environment. Interesting things happen on the edge of anything.
When you first see the Wave Organ, it looks like a prehistoric site, as if Stonehenge toppled over. But it's not creepy. It's almost soothing, a place that invites you to listen. There are benches built into the stones surrounded by curved concrete pipes that reach up like tentacles, carrying the sound.
It's almost like a Greek mythical experience, you know, of listening to the songs of the sirens or something that are coming through these strange-looking orifices.
Those orifices are the tops of the concrete pipes. They're how the Wave Organ amplifies the sounds of the bay. Richards was the director of art programs at the Exploratorium for 27 years and is still an artist in residence. One day, while he was explaining how sound works to someone at the museum, he had an idea, and he wanted to test it out on the ocean.
That day, I brought a piece of PVC pipe out here and stuck it in the water, and sure enough, it was there. He was just waiting for somebody to come along and grab it. And that's what I did.
What he grabbed through that PVC pipe was the voice of the ocean. Hearing it made him want to build a sound garden, a way to share the experience. But he couldn't do it alone. So he found a stonemason, a man named George Gonzalez, to help him.
He was in charge of the stonework, and I was in charge of the plumbing, so to speak.
Together, they had to learn how to play the sea, like a musical instrument.
And it was a matter of trial and error, putting in pipes and letting the tide come in and see what they sounded like, and until finally we got one that sounded good, and then we'd sort of freeze that shape, and then I would encase it in concrete and put it back in.
The project took 9 months. On its own, the ocean makes a sort of white noise. A mixture of hundreds of different frequencies. But the pipes of the wave organ let you hear those frequencies in a new way. Basically, when a wave hits the pipe,
it activates the fundamental frequency of that pipe.
To understand what a fundamental frequency is, Peter told us to think of a wine bottle.
If you just hit the end of the wine bottle, it'll make a thumping sound, right? It'll have a certain note or frequency.
Like this.
And if you fill the wine bottle up by half, you know, the frequency will go up. So it's the same thing. The each pipe is an air column or an air chamber. And when the wave hits into the pipe, it creates a vibration that makes that air column resonate at a certain frequency or sound note.
To hear the sound, you have to get really close to the pipes. Basically, stick your whole ear inside and wait. As the water fills the pipe, there's less air, and that makes the pitch get higher.
It's quite melodic. It's quite beautiful. This energy comes as a result of the relationship between the Earth and the Sun, which determines the seasons and the weather, and it's also the relationship between the Earth and the Moon, which affects the tides. So those sort of synchronous relationships determine what you're going to hear at any given time.
High tide is an awesome time to come, because the more water there is in the pipes, the louder the sound is. People find connection there. The wave organ has been the backdrop for weddings, picnics, first dates.
I have this underlying philosophy that if people feel more connected to their surroundings, they'll feel more responsible for it.
Some people might think that they're coming out to this remote place to escape from the world. But coming here isn't an escape. It's just hearing the world in a different way. For Cross Currents, I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum.
That story was co-produced by Maya DePaola Hanica. A lot of you called in with guesses to this week's audiograph sound, and the winner is Ellen Sineko. Congratulations, Ellen. You win a Cross Currents t-shirt. Woo! Check out past audiograph sounds of the week online. You can find them at kalw.org. Audiograph is the Bay Area's sonic signature. As you can probably tell by now, we do a lot of listening around here, and it's changed the way we hear the world. And yes, more and more, we're hearing the music in regular sounds. So here's what Martina heard after her conversation with Bernie Krause.
So I'm in my laundry room in my apartment building, and I'm going to share with you the sound of the dryer. Okay, do you hear that? It goes, it's a lower note. It goes.
And this is what happened when Julie started listening closely to her daily life.
So I'm in my bathtub, and one of the things I've been doing a lot lately is dunking my head, my ears underwater, and just laying there listening to what things sound like through water. So, are you ready? Here we go.
These musical sounds we've shared with you from our daily lives have inspired our resident sound engineer and composer to see what they'd sound like if maybe they were all happening at the same time. So, in honor of Bernie Krause's Great Animal Orchestra, we present to you the Great Cross Currents Orchestra. Hit it, Seth!
Roger, remain seatbelted in.
Bravo, composer Seth. And that's it for today's orchestra edition of Cross Currents. The show is produced by Martina Castro and Julie Kane, edited by Casey Miner, and engineered by Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor, and Holly Kernan is our news director. Special thanks to the Stanford Storytelling Project, to Maya DePaola Hanica and Liz Pfeffer for their production help, and to Mary Willis for her wonderful fact-checking prowess. And to the rest of our team for their musical recordings, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Alyssa Katnick, Mary Reese, Christine Stelakis, and Ray Sue Sussman. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option to our reporters. They're online at citycarshare.org. And mostly thanks to you. KALW is listener-supported, local, and independent radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
On Cross Currents from KALW News, we're not shy about taking on the big stories.
I can't imagine a cow working out in the city. They're just too big.
Well, maybe not that big.
But I think probably you could do sheep.
Oh, most definitely. We go digging for stories wherever we can find them. Some pop up in the tiniest of places.
We are still less than a speck on a mote on the skin of an elephant.
Or in the furthest recesses of the Bay Area, like the Santa Cruz Mountains.
That's actually not a lion on a hunting rampage. It's a female looking for love.
In all the wrong places?
I am like a rabbit. I am replete with ideas, and I am just hopping around, ready to do it.
So are we on Cross Currents. Take a walk on the wilder side with us, weekdays at 5 on KALW 91.7. Yes,